Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nedelsky. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl, here. Yep. And we just got back a week ago, San Diego, my old stomping ground, where we attended and even spoke at the yearly or annual Obesity Society's conference on obesity called Obesity Week. And we wanted to go over just a few little things, little updates that are going on in the obesity medicine and science world. So I think to start things off, first of all, I spoke about the idea of resistance training. It was a debate, actually, kind of a debate, although it was more of a fun discussion, I think. The debate was resistance training versus aerobic training for the management of obesity or long-term fat loss. And the gist of my argument, and we may have my opponent on here sometime to talk about, actually, yeah. I had to go against one of the most renowned exercise obesity researchers out there. His name's John Jakicic. He's at the University of Kansas now, I believe.
Yeah, he used to be in Pittsburgh.
But he's the one that spoke and taught at our obesity review, medicine review courses on exercise and weight loss and the management of obesity. So he took the side of aerobic training. I don't think he really had a choice. I signed up for the resistance training. They asked me to do it. And nobody signed up for the other side. And they said, hey, man, you got to do this because nobody signed up. So we did it. Anyway, it was funny because he's kind of he's one of my idols when it comes to exercise and weight loss and research. So the gist of my argument was that exercise doesn't really help that much for weight loss that we see acutely. Anyway, maintenance when it comes to exercise is pretty important, and it looks like the data is strong there. Just for when you're looking at the acute weight loss phase where people are starting to lose weight as opposed to trying to keep it off, it doesn't look like exercise adds that much more to diet, you know, diet somewhere around 5% on average, by the way.
Yeah.
So average,
everyone's different.
Diet gets around somewhere around 4 to 6% with a good intensive therapy, 4 to 6% total body weight. Exercise may add a percent or two to that. And over time, that starts kind of decreasing. You know, we don't have great data over very long periods of time. We have the look ahead trial, which we've talked about before. We have diabetes prevention and some of these other long-term studies. But when you look at exercise, it doesn't really add much. And now I gave him a little tidbit though. When you look at his study, he's done these studies. When you look at those who do the absolute most, meaning 200 minutes per week, on average, those people do tend to do a lot better than those who do like fewer than 150 minutes per week. But what happens over a long period of time, it's really hard to maintain that. So my argument was like, hey, there's a ton of volume that you need for aerobic training to make it effective for long-term weight loss and keeping it off, because that's the reason you do it, not necessarily that acute weight loss phase. It's really hard to get that much volume. We all have, you know, whatever, family, jobs, just life in general. Again, if you can do it, that's great. But my argument was that resistance training, which head-to-head against aerobic training, it does worse in terms of fat loss. It just does, because that's the amount of energy you're burning. You just can't burn that much due to the volume that you're doing of exercise and physical activity. The argument was that it's just so much better at retaining muscle mass or lean tissue, not only just muscle, but bone, specifically if you're doing hack squats, front squats. That's an inside joke with me and my brother. But if you're doing, if you're holding onto your bone as you lose weight, which is very important, especially in the elderly, we had our osteoporosis lecture or podcast. If you haven't heard that one, go listen to that. But resistance training is so powerful compared to aerobic training, and we have these newer therapies so good that are so powerful for weight loss that, like, hey, since we're not going to add any more weight loss with these other, with aerobic training, why don't we just focus on at least a minimal effective dose of physical activity in terms of just retaining lean mass. So anyway, I think I was the people's champ, but in the end, I don't have a ton of data supporting it. It's more of a conceptual, hypothetical type of thing. So that was the gist of my debate. Anything, any other little tidbits?
Yeah. Well, yeah, first of all, I mean, you guys both did a great job presenting your sides. I mean, he obviously made the argument that if we're going to really, really choose one or the other, which in reality, we don't want to do, and we want to personalize therapy, that technically aerobic training does do better for weight, in air quotes, loss, than resistance training head to head. But that also doesn't take into account the different types of resistance training that can include a little bit higher volume, you know, circuit training, that sort of thing. And he did make a point, though, with a lot of aerobic training that it is actually any exercise is good for muscle retention, lean mass retention when we're losing weight through diet. So he did make that point to kind of counter the, you know, resistance training, how important we obviously feel it is for lean mass retention during weight loss with diet and these new medications.
Yeah, any activity is better than none.
But also, I think you guys both did a good job of saying, while the debate was supposed to be a fun discussion on weight loss per se, that when we treat obesity, obesity is the disease of excess and abnormally distributed adipose tissue that causes harm to our health. And exercise is medicine for you. So we always tell people that when we're working on treating their obesity, that the exercise we're prescribing is for what's on the inside that counts. It's for the health of them. It's treating obesity, but not necessarily their weight. And then, and so that's an important point I think you guys both touched on, even though that wasn't exactly the debate. But I think it's maybe the most important. And it actually sort of, I think, kind of fits in with your argument in that when we're using these medications and surgeries, by the way, where there's a lot of evidence for exercise, retaining lean muscle and improving the weight, actually, that probably you get more bang for the buck if you focus on the resistance training because we want to retain the muscle. Muscle's healthy. Muscle's good for people. We want to help bone health and resistance training. I still would say wins the debate for you. And I actually wrote an article for Doximity about this. We'll see if they publish it. But I did ultimately say that my bias towards you as my brother and weight training probably makes me, you know, a little on that side, and that you won the debate. But
also, this podcast is called Docs Who Lift.
I know. So, you know, we have a pretty strong bias, literally. But also, you know, going back to the whole weight loss on average, all the studies basically say the exercise interventions that are done, you get the 1-2% weight loss on average. But the reason we keep talking and harping on the average is because everyone's so different. That's why those things called the waterfall plots, where you see the response of each person, are really interesting, because some people gain weight, hopefully muscle, some, all the way down to people who have no change in weight, to those who really do lose a lot of weight. Hopefully most people have some improvement in body composition, and we know that it's healthy for everyone, no matter what it is. But going back to the obesity as a disease, everyone has different compensatory mechanisms. So some people end up just taking in more energy than what they're burning because if they're not controlling for it. And so there's just a lot of individual variability with exercise for weight loss per se, but weight isn't what we really care about. It's what's on the inside that counts. It's the clinical benefits. We think resistance training takes a hint of a priority over aerobic training, but there are a lot of health benefits with all of it.
Yeah, ideally you do, you know, what you can do. Yeah. Some sort of mix if possible. Optimally, yeah, you would do a mix, but yeah, whatever you're going to be able to do, just do that at least.
And, you know, another point that you guys both sort of debated a little bit was the non-exercise physical activity. So he was often, you know, kind of hinting at trying to use some of the data for very light exercise, like walking
leisurely is not aerobic exercise.
Right. So that was your argument.
That was my, I was like, whoa, hold on a second.
But, But in the end, ultimately, you know, you both talked about how being as physically active all the time, even if it's not exercise, is important. So,
correct.
You know, so good things from both sides. I thought you guys both did a great job. You were entertaining as always. So if anybody wants to pay to watch it or listen to it, it would be worth their time.
The people's, I call myself the people's champ because I didn't have the data, but I was definitely...
You had some data.
Some data, but
it wasn't exactly for the winning that specific debate.
Right. What the hell? We are. You know, we are potentially collecting some data in the future that might answer some of these questions. But that's all we're going to say about that. So there are some other things. They're looking to the future, and we love the cutting edge potential therapies for weight loss. And so we've talked about the GLP-1 medicines with semaglutide. We've talked about the combo GLP/GIP in terms of tirzepatide. But there are new medications that some of these trialists that are studying these, which we may actually have on the podcast at some point, talking about these newer combinations that are they're going to be even better. They're going to be better than semaglutide, tirzepatide. It's going to get to a point where we're hitting bariatric surgery type results. Again,
which
costs.
Really, we already are with semaglutide and tirzepatide.
Yeah, we are for individuals. Yes, on average, you know, again, you know, we're hitting a 20%, which is it's just amazing. I've never seen anything like this. Now that I'm using a lot of tirzepatide, especially, but some of these newer combos, I think that's worth discussing. They're going to start having these, even glucagon. Even there's some that are like the mechanisms start getting really weird because then they start blocking some of them.
Yeah,
it makes there's antagonists, agonists, all sorts of stuff. There's one that we've talked about before where they have a. They add semaglutide with this amylin agonist called cagrilintide, another hormone that comes from your pancreas. Amazing weight loss there. I think we're going to see all sorts of pretty cool stuff. Yeah. And other companies are starting to jump in as well, which is nice because competition should
hopefully bring... Hopefully that helps bring costs down and availability as we go forward.
So otherwise I'm going to personally bankrupt this country by prescribing all of it to everybody.
Yeah. And that's the truth.
Here's the other thing. So, you know, we don't take money from Big Pharma, not yet. Again, I don't know if we will, but, you know, we get lots of offers to potentially shill out for some of these, companies, and you know we're not sure if we're going to or not. We don't know if it would I don't know if it would make a difference or not of what people think. If we just believe heavily in these new therapies, and we just think I love them because they're
scientifically sound. They have great benefits and great safety profiles, and so they are.
They're changing people's lives. I mean, just. Yeah.
I don't know if you had clinic today. I just got done with my morning clinic and followed up on a fair amount of people with obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and several of them are on one of these approved medications, whether it's semaglutide or tirzepatide for right now. And no fewer than two of them said something along the lines of, this has changed my life for the better. And
it's quite incredible.
Outstanding. You know, during the obesity week, they did publish the semaglutide trial in adolescents.
Yeah, that's big news.
That is a big news because pediatric obesity is
extremely difficult.
Now, we can talk about some of the very rare, not very rare, but the rare genetic syndromes that we do have some medicine for that we can talk about. But for most people, you know, when it's that polygenic or the usual obesity, it's difficult. And now we have phenermine topiramate that's approved. It's been studied with some benefit and approved for adolescents. And then, but semaglutide in teens, I mean, it was really good outcomes.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of that's a game changer for adolescent obesity, at least.
Yeah. So for those who are listening, have parents, you know, parents with kids who are struggling with their weight, might be an option to discuss. We don't do it in telemedicine just yet in my program, but you know, you may be able to discuss with your physician. They may not feel comfortable doing it, so there are physicians on abom.org that may be of use in your area. So check that out. What else? Oh, there's some interesting mice studies on tirzepatide, which are kind of interesting. You know, potentially showing increased energy expenditure.
A hint. You know,
my guess is that it's not going to pan out in humans. But what I do think, and I see anecdotally, is that people lose weight rapidly, and then they said, "I'm moving more," and I think probably because they feel better to move. That's what that's what I'm guessing. Yeah. I don't think there's a
and that may be the most important part of it too. I mean, if there, you know, maybe there's a hint of improved metabolism. So when we start talking about, you know, working in the area of the hypothalamus that controls our appetite and metabolism, et cetera, you know, maybe doing the right stuff up there does help some of the metabolic rate a little bit. But it's hard to say that it can be really, really relevant. But if there's any little bit, that's kind of nice, as long as there's no adverse effects. But if it's helping people be more physically active. We were just talking about non-exercise physical activity. And when people lose weight, and if they feel well doing it, as opposed to just starving themselves, not having the medical support, and they start increasing that non-exercise activity, well, that makes up a really good amount of the energy expenditure. You know, you had that in your talk.
Yeah.
You had that, I don't know, it was kind of that column that shows the percentage of someone's metabolic
rate. It's from Eric Trexler, who we want to have on the podcast, from Greg Nugget, the Stronger by Science guys. He actually wrote a paper, and that was, I used it as a meme once, and he's like, "Hey, that's from my paper." I'm like, "My bad. I saw it on like Google Images, but now I made sure to cite him in the actual that slide." But yeah, it shows the components of the total daily energy expenditure where you have your thermic effect of feeding, which is the energy you expend trying to digest food. You have exercise activity thermogenesis. So whenever you're doing purposeful exercise, that's the amount of energy you're burning during that. And then there's non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is pretty much any movement and energy you're burning that's not purposeful exercise or basal metabolic rate or what you're burning while eating. And so then, of course, you have your basal metabolic rate. So, but what people don't understand is that they always concentrate on their basal metabolic rate as their metabolism going down when they lose weight. But a lot of it is actually non-exercise activity because they're not moving around as much. And it can make a big difference, and people just don't realize it.
It really makes the biggest difference.
Yeah.
I mean, even when you look at, like, you know, some of Kevin Hall's The Biggest Loser trials and stuff like that, and talk about the metabolic adaptation and, you know, the regains mostly from food intake, and it kind of gets into all that stuff where, you know, a lot of the compensation that happens in people is they end up not moving much. That's the problem.
So that's why I made the other argument for resistance training, because that resistance training seems to conserve that the best compared to aerobic training. Because if you think about this, if you do high intensity or at least moderate intensity, and you're going for runs and bikes, you may feel tired. So you may not want to get off the couch and do whatever compared to, like, oh, if you did resistance training, you now aren't wiped for the rest of the day, unless you just absolutely destroyed it in the gym and did so many squats you can't even walk anymore. But, like, in general, resistance training does a better job at minimizing the decreases in non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So anyway, again, it's hypothetical. We have to show the outcomes. We haven't necessarily done that.
So anyways, but yeah, going back to it, the tirzepatide maybe showed a little bit of benefit for metabolism in addition to reducing the food intake in mice. If that translates to humans at all, that's a good thing. It may not really matter that much ultimately. Other public or presentations on tirzepatide were a lot of analyses of the big SURMOUNT-1 trial that Dr. Yastreboff presented at the ADA last year and published in New England Journal of Medicine. Just little tidbits. They talked about how there are significant improvements in the health-related quality of life in these patients.
So that's, I can believe it.
very important, obviously. It didn't really matter what BMI category someone was in, whether their BMI was 50 or 27. They had good overall, you know, relative weight loss and thus improved health outcomes from that. So that was good. And I think when they went across age groups also, it showed benefit across like all age groups, very similar benefits. So those are some of the tirzepatide nuggets, I think, that came out of that.
Yeah. I mean, anything else nothing else was pretty, was breaking. It's a lot of just cutting edge obesity therapies. I mean, and continuing to study these current therapies that we have, but we're going to kind of give it to you guys who are listening, guys and gals, y'all. We're going to be giving it to you as it comes in on a weekly basis.
I thought there was, it was interesting, you know, going back to the rare genetic disorders. One, I got to you, it was before you got there. I got to see Dr. Faruqi, who is the global leader in genetic causes of obesity. She's at Cambridge University overseas. And one, we need to get her on the podcast. She articulates genetic obesity so well. Obviously, I mean, she's the expert, but not everyone can articulate these things, right? Even if you're the expert, and she does. So, you know, we talked about this medicine called setmelanotide that is a melanocortin 4 receptor agonist, and it skips over some of the very monogenic disorders that make these other things we're talking about not work well, you know, and so kids who have severe obesity when they're growing up, they may have some of these disorders. The trial that was published that I think is a big deal that used setmelanotide was in those who have hypothalamic obesity. So hypothalamic obesity is when there has been damage to the hypothalamus, which is the area of the brain we keep talking about that is like the control center for so many of these things like energy intake, metabolism, sleep, et cetera. And I think it's really important that this showed benefit in hypothalamic obesity because this has been a disorder that's very difficult to treat, and it's a real struggle. This can happen from brain tumors, something called craniopharyngiomas that require surgery, and when you damage that area of the brain, people have severe weight gain and obesity.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had actually a few patients asking about that medicine. You got to talk about like it hits, what is it, downstream or upstream? It hits downstream. So if we're because GLP-1 can have an effect on the POMC, which then has an effect on MC4. Whatever, it doesn't matter. Anyway, this is going further up the road and hitting the receptors that ultimately control appetite, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. Only approved for certain syndromic or genetic causes, leptin receptor, leptin deficiency, POMC.
Leptin issues. Receptor deficiency, not leptin. Yeah, leptin deficiency, you have to use metreleptin, which is
leptin receptor, way,
millions of dollars, which is crazy. But leptin receptor deficiency, POMC deficiency, PCSK1 deficiency, which is an enzyme that converts essentially the proopioid melanocortin, the POMC, to the alpha melanocyte stimulating hormone, which goes then to the melanocortin 4 receptor up in the higher areas. And that's where this setmelanotide works because it skips over all that stuff, all the stuff that we usually talk about where there might be these disorders. Bardet-Biedl syndrome has a problem.
I think that one just got added, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, just recently added for the, after the trials came out this past year, it's approved for that too.
I've had some people come to me with MC4 receptor mutations. I'm not sure if that would work.
Well, so what Dr. Faruqi said, because people asked about that, I'm sure all of our listeners are really interested in this, but they don't know. Yeah. So for what it's,
someone might have.
The thought is that for, cause that's where it's working, right? So if the receptor, the melanocortin 4 receptor is a problem, then setmelanotide may not work as well, obviously, but the thoughts were that it might work well enough.
Okay.
Yes. That's good. Maybe there's some benefit. So they're studying it. It's literally being studied right now.
I've literally had a few of those. I'm like, shoot. I'm like, I don't know if it would work or not.
That's interesting. Cause I think that's a little bit more common than some of these other ones that it's actually approved for. And so that's difficult.
Well, I hope they do study it. Okay.
Anyways. Yeah.
All right. I don't think there's much else that we needed to discuss? There was, you know, we went to one of our buddies, Dr. Scott Kahan's lecture. He had a lecture similar to yours and talking about, yeah, you know, beyond BMI. We've talked about this. Ketlet Keys created this BMI. And he talks about the history of it and how it doesn't fit an individual very well. It does well on population level. And we always want to emphasize, like, yeah, BMI is just a screener. That's it. Like, yeah, you look at me, I have overweight. Sometime in the past I'd had obesity just based on BMI, but you know, most of it's muscle. You know, maybe when my abs are a little bit blurry,
God,
I might've had sleep apnea though. So I might've been able to,
yeah, that's
convince
true,
people. To,
that was back in the day though, when you were trying
my
to be
neck
heavyweight.
Was, but my neck was huge. My neck's, yeah, not nearly as big anymore. Sleep apnea.
But anyways, yeah, the point of it is, you know, if you don't get too hung up on BMI, BMI doesn't necessarily make a diagnosis. It is a good screener to say, hey, this person may have excess adiposity. Does this person have complications of it? And really, we should be staging the severity of obesity based upon complications of obesity or the risks of those complications. You know, more of an individual clinical aspect as to, do they even have excess adiposity? And what are we going to do about it? And then also help us, you know, guide our response to therapy. So, you know, forget BMI, but are we improving their diabetes, they're getting rid of prediabetes and getting rid of their sleep apnea, improving their fatty liver and their health related quality of life. And those are the things that really are our goals, not, yep, just weight. So we got to get away from a weight centric. Yep.
It's a little bit tougher. Anyways. Takes some effort from the clinician standpoint, but
yeah.
All right. I think that's about it. This is Diabetes Awareness Month that we've had our, podcasts on that. We also really want to get a few lecturers, podcaster people on talking about weightlifting more in children. We had our podcast going from cradle to grave with Dante Burks, which was great. But I kind of want to get into some of the research in lifting in kids and just keep spreading this idea of lifting as medicine. And maybe some of these obesity drug trialists will get on here soon. So
yeah.
Thanks awesome. For listening. Give us a review. Share with your friends.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.